Welcome back. 25 minutes left in open lines. After that, we'll be talking with Dr. James Dredke about the Hajj, about the annual pilgrimage to Mecca and Mount Arafat. You may have read about it in the paper. That's coming up in a half hour. Until then, it's open lines for your questions and your comments. One of the questions I put on the table has to do with President George W. Bush and his, well, regular references to divine providence and his place in divine providence. Do you get the sense, as does Deborah Caldwell, writing for BeliefNet.com, that this president considers himself called to this position by God, appointed there by God himself, a man of destiny in the divine sense? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before the break, I told you about this op-ed piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I will read in part for you. It has to do with the death penalty in Missouri. Oh, by the way, before I get to that, what's coming up a little bit later, Pastor Tom Baker is coming up a little later. He is going to be trying to draw the connection between two things that Christians often think are the opposite. Absolute despair, utter despair, and saving faith. We'll see what he has to say in part five of our seven-part series on the theology of the cross versus the theology of glory. Let's talk with April, who's calling from Manchester. April, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor. How are you, sir?
Very well.
Good, good. I wanted to call and let you know about something that took place up on Merrimack Community Campus a couple weeks ago that my husband overheard.
What was that?
On campus. Well, I think you'll find it refreshing and encouraging to find out that between 5 and 10 students were gathering together outside on the campus grounds, and they're discussing about the Planned Parenthood organization. And this is what is so encouraging and refreshing. They made reference and were being rather cynical towards Planned Parenthood in the statement that they made. They said, Planned Parenthood, it sounds more like, to me, a planned avoidance of adult responsibility.
Well, that's very interesting.
And I was like, out of the mouth of babes. Yeah. And these are, you know, young folks, you know, late teens, early 20s, what have you. But John, you know, and I are very active in the pro-life ministry now. And so he couldn't help but have his ears perked when they were talking about that. And, jesting about that, and I thought, you know, things are working. People are wising up.
April, thank you very much for the call. This is not a unique phenomenon. I mean, that's an anecdotal account of the younger people, the young folks, being more pro-life. Now, this is not only demonstrable by surveys. I think there's also a reason for it. The reason that young college-age people are generally cynical of the pro-choice movement and of the whole abortion movement, period. It's a very simple reason. We've talked about it before. These young people consider themselves to be survivors of abortion. All of them are under 30. That means all of them have grown up in a country where abortion has been decriminalized. They have never known in America, they have never lived in a country where abortion was anything other than legal. And each one of them has drawn the conclusion, a lot of them have drawn the conclusion, that they too could have been the victim of abortion. They are here only because, why? Their parents wanted them. Some of them know full well, or perhaps suspect, that they have siblings who did not survive the cut. Especially if their parents are pro-choice. I mean, these 4,000 a day, these 40 million in 30 years, they have to have come from someplace, right? And these young people know that it's from their families, their friends' families, that these aborted children were taken. They know it, and they consider themselves survivors. I think that goes a long way toward explaining why younger people are so cynical about the abortion movement, about the pro-choice movement. Now, sad to say, a lot of that effect is mitigated by the time some of these kids get out of university. They become the recipients of pro-choice propaganda, and what they knew by virtual common sense when they came in, they have forgotten by the time they get out, or they found a way of explaining it away. And they know, just by looking around, that they are not better off having lived in an America where abortion is legal. They know that women are no better off, having lived in an America where abortion is legal. And they know that they are the survivors and that there would have been, were it not for Roe v. Wade, that there would have been 40 million more of them. And they look around saying, where are they? Remember those, they used to do this with the drug policy? I remember when I was in high school, someone came in to talk to us about drugs. And I think it may have been a police officer. The first thing he said to get our attention was, looking out at a class of about 30 kids there, said, 10 years from now, two of you will be dead because of drugs. I remember him saying this and thinking to myself, oh, is he talking about me? You know, everyone's looking at one another. They've already figured out who it is. Did you get a talk like that in high school? Wouldn't that be an effective talk to high school kids to walk in and say, were it not for Roe v. Wade, there would, let's say it's a group of 30, were it not for Roe v. Wade, there would be seven more of you sitting here. Seven more kids for the football team, basketball team, seven more kids to go to college out of 30. Because it's true. It's not the future prospect of people having lost their lives. They're gone. Seven empty chairs in every classroom of 30 because of abortion. The kids don't have to be professional ethicists to figure this out. Back to this op-ed piece from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, The Death of Innocence. I was encouraged when I saw the title, and then more and more discouraged as time went on. It's an editorial. Innocence alone is not good enough reason to avoid executing someone on Missouri's death row. That extraordinary claim was made by Attorney General Jay Nixon's office last week. Frank Young, Mr. Nixon's assistant, told the Missouri Supreme Court that it could not stop the execution of a person it knew to be innocent based upon incontrovertible DNA evidence unless there was a constitutional defect with the person's trial. Mr. Young insisted that the court could not interfere with the death sentence imposed on Joseph R. Amreen for a 1985 prison murder. All three prisoners who testified against Amreen have since recanted. One guard who saw the scuffle identified another inmate. As absurd as the state's position is, Mr. Nixon stands behind it. He says that decades of U.S. Supreme Court decisions back him up. Although most Americans don't realize it, the U.S. Supreme Court says that federal courts cannot stop executions just because the defendant is probably innocent. Although, if you're governor of Illinois and on your way out, your last day in office, you can do it. But the purpose of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, the editorial goes on, is to make it hard for federal courts to second-guess state convictions in order to show respect for the state courts. It's called the principle of comity. But comity makes sense only if the state courts shoulder responsibility for the accuracy of the death sentence. Otherwise, the process becomes absurd, an absurd merry-go-round of meaningless court decisions that send innocent people to their deaths. Mr. Nixon argues that the governor can always save the innocent person from execution, but Amreen's lawyer, Sean O'Brien, pointed out that the innocent man can't always count on the governor. Quote, history in Missouri has shown that the Pope's travel itinerary has more to do with the governor's exercise of his clemency power than the fact of the case, if you remember, of course, that then Governor Mel Carnahan was moved to clemency in 1999. The Amreen case itself demonstrates that condemned prisoners can't count on the governor. The Post-Dispatch identified Amreen 3 years ago as one of the three men on Missouri's death row with a strong case of wrongful conviction. Governor Bob Holden said a year ago that he was giving the case a close look. Nothing has happened. After the argument in the Amreen case, Mr. Nixon said that he would take appropriate action if evidence of innocence surfaced. But Mr. Nixon has a track record of pushing for the execution of men with strong cases of wrongful convictions, such as Roberts and Larry Griffin, who were executed in 1995. Mr. Holden and Mr. Nixon have repeatedly said that the Missouri's death penalty system is not broken. They're not only wrong, they're part of the reason it is broken. That's the St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial. Now, if we're talking about wrongful conviction, that's one thing. We have a system of courts that can prove guilt or innocence, and we have a system of courts that can also judge whether or not there's been a wrongful conviction. That's not rocket science. But I think there's more in this editorial that's being unstated, as though every person on death row is kind of potentially innocent. Even after a trial, even after another trial on appeal, and sometimes even after another and another and another trial on appeal. It is maintained against the evidence. Now, there are exceptions, of course, but it's maintained against the evidence that everyone sitting on death row here in Missouri, everywhere else, all we have to do is talk about Governor George Ryan, is potentially innocent. And of course, we cannot execute perfect justice through our court system. That's impossible. We do our best. No one ever said the outcome would be completely flawless. But now the argument seems to be, if there are any flaws at all, we have to question the guilt and the innocence of every single convictee. I don't think it necessarily follows. And not everyone sitting on death row is potentially innocent. They were potentially innocent. They were innocent until proven guilty. And then after being proven guilty, unless better evidence comes to light, they remain guilty. On the other side of the coin, this from the New York Times, the Federal Court of Appeals in St. Louis yesterday said that officials in Arkansas can force a prisoner on death row to take antipsychotic medications to make him sane enough to execute. Without the drugs, the prisoner, Charles Laverne Singleton, they've always got three names. Charles Laverne Singleton could not be put to death under a United States Supreme Court decision that prohibits the execution of the insane. Yesterday's 6-5 decision is the first by a federal appeals court to allow such an execution. Singleton presents the court with a choice between involuntary medication, followed by an execution, and no medication, followed by psychosis and imprisonment. Judge Roger W. Wolman wrote in the majority ruling of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit here in St. Louis. Judge Wolman said the first choice was the better one, at least when the drugs were generally beneficial to the prisoner. He said the courts did not need to consider the ultimate result of the medicating the prisoner. Of course, the ultimate result of medicating the prisoner is that the prisoner actually is restored to full lucidity. It does not cause his death. Do you see what I'm saying here? You go to a psychologist's office, and you are in desperate need of lithium. You are schizophrenic. He gives you lithium. You feel better. You leave his office after an hour, and you get hit by a bus. Or you go out and decide to murder someone because now you're so lucid, you remembered what was upsetting you in the first place. This line of argumentation would hold the psychologist, the psychiatrist, whatever it may be, whichever of those two can medicate people. Let's just call him a healthcare professional, would hold him responsible for you murdering someone, or would hold him responsible for you getting hit by the bus. A guy sitting on death row should be medicated in order that his psychosis is alleviated. The fact that he's sitting on death row does not make medicating him for his psychosis the cause of his execution. He's going to be executed anyway. You see? Now, if he's insane and we shouldn't execute the insane, would we actually say, let's keep him insane and let him live? You see, the minute someone administers an antipsychotic drug to him and he's lucid again, he goes back to death row. This is not a case of the lesser of two evils. This is a case of a false cause and effect. The story goes on. Eligibility for execution is the only unwanted consequence of the medication, said the judge. He's got it right. Judge Gerald Heaney, in dissent, said that there was a third choice. He would have allowed Mr. Singleton to be medicated without fear of execution, which is basically to allow the doctors to overturn the death penalty. I believe, he wrote, that to execute a man who is severely deranged without treatment and arguably incompetent when treated is the pinnacle of what Justice Marshall called the barbarity of exacting mindless vengeance. Judge Heaney added that the majority's holding presented doctors with an impossible ethical choice. No, it is not an impossible ethical choice. Again, if the guy broke his arm, would we not put it in a splint, even if he's on death row? Wouldn't we put it in a cast? If he developed cancer, would we not at least alleviate his symptoms and treat the disease? And people would argue, well, if you let him live, he's going to die. That's right. The crime is what caused the execution. The crime and the conviction is the cause of the execution, justice being carried out. Whether or not he needs medication of any kind, even for psychosis, even in light of the Supreme Court's decision, does not in any way bring about the execution. The execution is going to happen. Now, the question of whether or not he was sane at the time of the crime is a different matter. What happened was Mr. Singleton killed a grocery store clerk in Arkansas back in 1979. I would just point out to you the date. We are arguing about a guy who committed a murder in 1979. Maybe the reason he's psychotic is because he's been sitting on death row since 1979 and justice has not been carried out. He was sentenced to death in that year. His conviction was affirmed in 1981 by the Arkansas Supreme Court, in 1986 by the U.S. Supreme Court, also held an opinion by Justice Thurgood Marshall that the execution of the insane was barred by the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. Mr. Singleton's mental health began to deteriorate in 1987. What? Had we been swifter in the execution of justice, we wouldn't be asking this question. And I know that sounds cruel, but you leave a man on death row that long, I think that amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. And he believed that his prison cell was possessed by demons and that the prison doctor had implanted a device in his ear. Give him his medicine and execute him. In December 2001, he wrote to the appeals court to inform them that he did not believe his victim was dead, and that she was somewhere on earth waiting for me, her groom. Again, there's a simple explanation for this. Fully apprise him of the seriousness of his crimes by giving him his medication, and then carry out the sentence that was handed down, for heaven's sakes, over 20 years ago. They were planning a peace march in Manhattan, according to the New York Times, but a federal judge ruled yesterday that it's not going to happen for the reasons of security. Anti-war demonstrators may not march past the UN on Saturday or anywhere else in Manhattan, a federal judge ruled yesterday, agreeing with the city at large, moving a rally of 100,000 people or more raised serious security risks. The judge said the organizers would have to settle for a stationary rally 5 blocks north of the complex. In refusing to grant the parade permit, the city did not violate the demonstrators' First Amendment rights, said the judge, Barbara Jones, of the Federal District Court in Manhattan. She wrote in her opinion rejecting their request for a preliminary injunction. She said that their free speech rights were adequately protected by the city's counteroffer to rally for 10,000 people at Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza on 42nd Street. It has overflow space as far north as First Avenue. Judge Jones said that the city had offered compelling reasons for not being able to guarantee the safety of the marchers or of the United Nations complex, where all the demonstrations and parades have been banned since the terrorist attack that destroyed the World Trade Center. The judge noted that the city had presented evidence about two incidents, a failed bomb plot of New York landmarks, including the United Nations, and a case of a gunman who scaled the front fence of the United Nations in October and fired pistol shots through the upper windows to protest human rights violations in North Korea. So peace marchers are not having the best day when it comes to, I don't know what they're worried about. If they wanted to protest someplace, it wouldn't be the UN. The UN doesn't seem in particularly a warlike mood at this particular moment. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Still a few minutes left in open lines. Dr. Gene Edward Veith, one of our regular guests, has written in World Magazine about a population implosion. He says many nations are aborting their future generations, creating a worldwide underpopulation crisis. Remember back in the 70s, the population bomb, we were told that the world would be overpopulated by now? They found a solution for it here in America. It's called abortion. The president of Estonia goes on national TV to urge his countrymen to have more children. Russian President Vladimir Putin warns his parliament about a serious crisis threatening Russia's survival, the nation's low birth rate. The government of Singapore is trying to reverse that country's birth dearth by sponsoring a massive taxpayer-funded matchmaking service. Leave it to Singapore, where it's illegal to chew gum, and the government can hitch you up with a woman. In 1968, Paul Ehrlich published The Population Bomb, panicking the world with dire predictions of a population explosion. By the year 2000, he predicted the world would be so crowded that hundreds of millions would die of starvation. Although Mr. Ehrlich's prophecies turned out to be almost comically wrong, PBS has produced a documentary taking him seriously, and philanthropists like Ted Turner still donate millions to combat population growth. But the problem today is not overpopulation, it's underpopulation. For a population to reproduce itself, the fertility rate must average 2.1 children per woman. All right, no one expects any women to turn out a 0.1 of a child, but this is how statistics work. Two is enough. The fertility rate today among major developed nations is only 1.6. The United States is rare among its peers in keeping its fertility rate around replacement level of 2.1, according to the Population Reference Bureau, which is providing the fertility data cited here. Europe, though, is shrinking. Germany's rate is 1.3. Despite the stereotype of large Catholic families, France has a fertility rate of about 1.9, and Italy has one of the lowest in Europe, matching that of Germany at 1.3. At this rate, there will be only about as half as many Italians in the next generation. There will also be fewer Russians, whose fertility rate is 1.3 as well. Maybe that's the solution to this whole war thing with Iraq. If we just wait long enough, Germany and France will disappear. There'll only be like one guy standing there with his wife, and she'll be pro-choice. And they'll still be saying, don't go to Iraq. I don't think we can afford to wait that long. Even nations that were once notorious for booming populations have drastically slowed down in reproducing themselves. In the last 20 years, India's fertility rate has gone from over 4 children per woman to about 3. Mexico has gone from 4 to just under 3. China, no surprise here, has a fertility rate of 1.8. Is this a good thing, he says? Why are so many governments panicking at the drop of their populations? Well, it's obvious. And the cause is obvious too, folks. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
St. Paul writes, I have become all things to all men, so that by all means I might save some. Now, does this mean that St. Paul was an advocate of marketing the church? The modern church growth movement answers yes. But in the new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, its author, Pastor Rod Zwanitzer, says no. You can order Testing the Claims of Church Growth by calling Concordia Publishing House during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. Or you can order the book online at our Issues Etc. website. issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House. Testing the Claims of Church Growth, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A new bill is being introduced this week in the House of Representatives that would make it a crime for stores to sell adult-rated video games to anyone under 18. It appears lawmakers will have to legislate the problem if retailers aren't prepared to do it themselves. David Brody reports from Washington.
It happens every day in America. 11-year-olds walking into video stores and buying mature-rated games like Grand Theft Auto Vice City. The object, to kill the prostitute and don't forget to take the money afterwards. Dave Walsh is president of the National Institute on Media and the Family.
People look at some of those games and literally their jaws drop and say, what is going on here?
In theory, retailers are supposed to stop minors before the purchase, but they aren't.
Because some of the retailers have kind of thumbed their nose at those requests for responsibility, and I think that bills like this really kind of signal that frustration.
Congressman Joe Baca is introducing the bill, and his legislative assistant Oscar Ramirez told me why it's such a vital issue.
When you have sex and violence on TV or in movies, that's bad enough, but studies have shown that video games is even worse because when you play them, you become part of that game. You're consciously making these decisions that do certain things.
This will be the second go-round for the legislation. In the last session of Congress, critics of the bill said the language was too broad. This version sets a simple standard. If it has strong sexual content and graphic violence, it's no good.
Constitutionally, experts believe that this has a better chance of passing constitutional scrutiny.
Maybe this video game bill will be the one that sticks. For Family News and Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
The penalty for stores that sell adult-rated video games to minors would be thousands of dollars. A government study found that close to 80% of kids 13 to 16 were able to purchase adult-rated games. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
You've heard the saying, all things being equal, friends buy from friends. Well, it gets even better when your friend sells you something for a much lower price than other people are paying. And Lifeline Long Distance is a Christian company. So we'll donate 10% of every long distance call you make for the advancement of the gospel. Hey, after all, what are friends for? Lifeline, long distance with a higher calling.
To sign up for Lifeline Long Distance service and benefit AM 850 KFUO, call 1-800-607-5128.
Are marketing principles compatible with Christian evangelism? Find out with the new book, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Testing the Claims of Church Growth is the Issues Etc. book of the month for February, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New. Testing the Claims of Church Growth, our Issues Etc. book of the month for February.
In just a minute or two, we'll be joined by Dr. James Dredke. We're going to talk about the Muslims' annual pilgrimage to Mecca. You may have read about it in the paper. There's even a picture. It really is a rather amazing picture of a Saudi security officer surveying the Grand Mosque in Mecca on Friday, just full of people. This is the last day people are returning to their homelands. This is something that Muslims do once in a lifetime if they are able. And we'll find out what it's all about and where it fits into the Islamic religion in just a few minutes. I'm right in the middle of Dr. Gene Edward Veith talking about the population implosion. Now, he's been giving these dire population growth figures for many major countries, and he goes on by saying African nations continue to have very high fertility rates, up to 5 or 6 children per woman. But those lands are ravaged by AIDS, which is decimating their populations on the other end of life. Muslim nations, on the other hand, tend to have booming population growth. Yemen's fertility rate is 7.2 children per woman. Think about this. Is there a reason why Islam is the fastest growing religion or one of the fastest growing religions on the planet? Maybe it's because, by and large, in nations where Christianity is politically dominant, abortion is legal, and there it isn't. Demographers predict that the world's population will level off at about 9 billion. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. Then it will start dropping. There may be nearly 500 million fewer people by 2075 than there are now. Is this a good thing, says Veith? Why are so many governments panicking at the drop of their populations, he asks. Although radical environmentalists like Mr. Ehrlich see human beings only as consumers of the Earth's resources, human beings are, in fact, the most valuable resource of all. Citizens are not just consumers, but producers as well. Having fewer people can wreak havoc on an economy, creating both a labor shortage and a shortage of buyers. A government with a shrinking population faces a smaller military, fewer taxpayers, and dwindling populations have always signaled cultural decline. Less creativity, energy, and vitality on every level of society. Already, Japan, with a fertility rate of 1.3, is facing the problem of having fewer tax-paying young people to support the burgeoning number of retirees, something that will hit a generous welfare state like Europe especially hard. Now think about us for a second, if you will. We had the baby boom, 70 million, from 1946 to 1964. 10 years later, abortion is legal. All the people in the workforce today are faced with the problem of supporting these boomers once they begin to retire. Many of them who've done well are beginning to retire now, but they're the ones who've done well and don't need their Social Security. The ones who have done mediocre or not so well will be retiring in the next decade. Baby boomers, the first wave of 70 million baby boomers, the ones that didn't either kill themselves with drugs in the 70s or go wandering off into the street someplace, will be asking for their Social Security, and they have aborted most of the children who will be paying into the coffers, at least one in four of them. Now, I'm not laying all of abortion at the baby booms, but no, someone didn't do the math before they started this. They didn't figure this out. Abortion is a factor in the Social Security equation. The first politician who figures this out and makes it an issue, and makes it an issue of money, will get a gold star from me. Already, Europe has had to import large numbers of immigrants to bolster the labor force, and it's true of all over Europe. This is how Veith wraps it up. Why the population decline? Worldwide collapse of what are literally family values, he says. Thanks to contraceptive technology, sex has become separate from childbearing. With women pursuing careers of their own and men getting sex without the responsibility of marriage, why bother with children? For many women and men, pregnancy has become an unpleasant side effect, something to prevent with contraceptives or easily treat with a trip to the abortion clinic. The dirty little secret of the population implosion, the myth of overpopulation. One seldom mentioned by demographers is that the world is aborting its future generations. China has shrunk its fertility rate by its cruel policy of forced abortion. The website of the International Planned Parenthood Federation has only good things to say about China, by the way, and does not even mention how the government coerces women to have abortion. So much for choice, if you live in China. In the United States, abortion ends between one-third and one-fifth of all pregnancies. And the U.S. abortion rate is relatively low. In Russia, the average woman may have as many as four abortions in her lifetime. There are two abortions for every live birth. So that to say Russia kills two-thirds of their children before they are born, that, Mr. Putin, is the serious crisis threatening Russia's survival. And if we're not careful here in America, ours as well. If you just want to put in terms of the bottom line, whether or not you baby boomers will get vote pro-life if you want your Social Security. If that's all that matters to you. I mean, if the life of the unborn doesn't matter to you at all, think about your golden years. And whether or not you'll be able to be supported by a population that has been cut by abortion by 25%. Today is the last day of the Hajj, the Muslims' annual pilgrimage to Mecca. What role does this play in the Islamic faith? What does it mean? It's obviously meant heightened security everywhere in the world over the last week or so. We're joined now by Dr. James Dredke, director of the Zwemer Institute for Muslim Studies, based in Fort Wayne, Indiana, to talk about the Hajj. Dr. Dredke, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
First of all, what are Muslims doing during this week? What are they finishing up today at this thing we call the Hajj?
What the Hajj is very interestingly a rehearsal of the fact that Abraham was called upon by God to sacrifice his son. And Muslims gather from all over the world if they can afford it once in their lifetimes. to do the rites and rituals that are a part of this program. And at the end of it, every household is called upon to sacrifice an animal in memory of what Abraham did when God himself substituted a sacrifice for his son.
Is it true that according to the Quran, it was not Isaac upon whom or whom God commanded Abraham to sacrifice, but in fact Ishmael?
Well, the Quran is a little bit unclear on this. It says his firstborn son, and therefore I would suppose that a majority of Muslims understand that to be Ishmael, and it's commonly said in Muslim writings that it was Ishmael. But I've met some Muslims who go along with the biblical account that it was Isaac.
Why Mecca, and why in particular Mount Arafat?
Long before Muhammad arose on the world scene, born about 570 A.D., started preaching in 610 A.D., long before he came, Arabs from that part of the world laid down their weapons and all gathered for an annual pilgrimage in Mecca. The cubical building that was there, called the Kaaba, we are told by Muslim authorities before the time of Muhammad, housed an idol for every day of the year. So roughly 370 idols. And then here rose up in their own city a man who started to preach that God alone was to be worshipped. In fact, he preached the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," and stirred up a lot of anger and animosity on the part of the ruling wealthy classes. He actually came from these classes of people. And yet, as he preached, he drew a following. Eventually, he had to move 200 miles to the north with his small group of followers to a place called Medina. And it's from there that in 630, he attacked his hometown of Mecca, destroyed all the idols, and then in a very strange development in a way, and yet it fit in with what has become Islam, he reinterpreted the whole pilgrimage into being a remembrance of Abraham, his family, and his son Ishmael.
So in other words, he really took what had been, by and large, at least according to the Muslims' version of history, he took what had been a pagan, essentially,
yes,
a pagan and indigenous kind of a pilgrimage, and, quote-unquote, baptized it for Allah.
Yes, he totally reinterpreted it, and in his reinterpretation of it, he said he saw himself, in a sense, as a... as a reformer, restoring the Kaaba to its original purposes. And Abraham was brought into the picture, Ishmael brought into the picture, and today, as Muslims finish up that pilgrimage, they will have sort of walked in the footsteps of Abraham. At one time, even confronting him with confronting the devil by throwing stones at him. And most Muslims, or let's say very many of them, come back with some of the waters from Zemzem, the well that was supposed to have been raised up when Hannah was thirsty. So I did a study on this whole situation once upon a time, trying to see if there wasn't some inner yearning here by way of this sacrifice to achieve forgiveness of sins. According to Muslim records and writings, it's a sacrifice of praise for the way in which God provides for his people. But talking with many Muslims who return from pilgrimage, they all have a sense of their sins having been forgiven in this rite and ritual that they go through.
So they believe that by making the pilgrimage to Mecca, that by praying before the Kaaba in the Grand Mosque, that by spending the days in prayer, the sacrifice of the goat or the cow, the camel, and this symbolic stoning of the devil, there's some sort of expiation taking place personally?
That's what happens or the sense that so many who participated in it feel. It's part of the requirements that God puts upon his creatures.
Is, according to Islamic teaching, is it required that every Muslim go? You said if they're able at the beginning. Is it required that every Muslim sometime in their life perform the Hajj?
This is the one pillar. There's the five other pillars. One is your creed. There's no God but God. Muhammad is his prophet. The second is praying five times in a day. The third is fasting during the month of Ramadan. And the fourth is giving the charity tax called the zakat. And then the fifth is pilgrimage. It's the only one that has an if with it. If you can afford it and take care of your family needs at the same time.
Is it your sense among American Muslims with whom you are acquainted, who are devout and serious about these five pillars of Islam, that they will make the Hajj, they will make the pilgrimage, they will make themselves able to do it, save the money and all that type of stuff?
Well, it's the feeling or the desire is much stronger among immigrant Muslims than I've ever met it among African-American Muslims, although it seems to be that the number of African-Americans planning on it is growing. You might have known that Malcolm X, on his pilgrimage, really had had a very deep spiritual experience, actually. It was so revolutionary to him that whites and blacks and browns, people of all kinds of colors, could be there going through the same spiritual renewal exercises. And when he began to talk about that on his return to the U.S., that really might have changed the face of black Islam in this country. He was assassinated shortly after that.
That was kind of the beginning of his era of pacifism and talking about peace, wasn't it?
Yes, actually.
Does this also explain why the Muslim, when he performs the five daily prayers, faces Mecca?
Yes, this is the reason.
So if you were to summarize how it is the Hajj, what role it is it plays in the life of the devout Muslim, how would you describe that?
I would describe it as a very deep spiritual experience that is one of the very dramatic instances of Muslims of all nationalities, races, and even genders humbling themselves before what they see as the presence of God in that particular place.
Is it a unifying force for worldwide Islam?
It's a unifying force. But even then, once everybody goes back home, they're back in the same kind of nationalistic, trenches, the different divisions of Islam, whether Shia or Sunni or whatever other group it might be, that sort of mountaintop experience of Mecca doesn't quite achieve what many Muslims ideally would like to see it, totally unifying Islam across the face of the earth.
Could you explain, if you're able, the apparent disconnect between the tenor of Islam here in the Western world, but in particular in America, and the tenor of Islam as we experience it out there in nations that are dominated not only religiously but also politically by Islam?
Probably the simplest part of trying to set up any kind of equation like that is that where Islam is politically in control, the whole system, there can be an effort to enforce it upon all the people. And one of the hard questions with which Muslims are wrestling in this country, can Islam be compatible with a democratic form of government? And there are some Muslims who are working hard to say, yes, it can. And there are others who, in fact, some of the information we have just been trying to track recently is there seems to be a lot of especially Pakistanis who are leaving America, going back to where they came from. And some of the feeling seems to be that they are not going to be able to fulfill all that Islam requires of them in this kind of an environment.
In other words, they consider the Western environment inimical to the full performance of their faith.
Yes.
What does that signal for you? In your mind, what becomes of a Muslim who perhaps has lived, maybe not even as an immigrant to the United States, but perhaps lived as an American their whole life, who says, I've got to decide between being an American or Westerner and being a Muslim, and I will choose the world of Islam?
Yes, I have only met a few American-born people who really seriously consider that kind of a question. I think for most other American Muslims, they perhaps are not that ready to give up all that America is to them to go and live under a Muslim regime. The feeling is very widespread, as you may know, that, as I heard when attending a public lecture in Southern California by one of the leaders and spokespersons for the Muslim community there, a surgeon by his profession, someone asked him in the meeting, one of the Muslims, which Muslim regime did he feel most closely fulfilled the ideals of the Sharia, Muslim law? And he didn't wait one second. He said, none. None of them are fulfilling the prescriptions of the Quran and the Sharia.
What would he think? I mean, what was the point there?
Well, the point was that, that this is the ideal that Muslim history and thought fosters, that there should be no separation of church and state, or in this instance of the mosque and state. It should be all one unified whole, as it was under Muhammad, and then the four successors, the caliphs who succeeded him. And so I just now heard again something like 52 Muslim nations, although I'd put a question mark over some of them. In theory, they should be all good, exemplary Muslim states. But in fact, according to what this man was saying, they're all monopolistic regimes, most of whom just use Islam as a club over their people.
In other words, Islam, Sharia law, whatever it may be, is a means to an end, is a means to despotism.
It all too often is exactly just that.
Can we really talk about worldwide Islam, given the disparity between the Western world and nations that are dominated by Islam, given the fact that there are very mutually contradicting factions of Islam worldwide, even in spite of the fact that with 1 billion Muslims worldwide, there are often millions and millions that travel for this yearly Hajj? Can we talk about worldwide Islam, or are we really talking about various offshoots of one religion?
That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a religion that has many different expressions, many different understandings of what Islam really involves, and to a certain extent, that really is somewhat healthy for the whole rest of the world, that Islam is as fractured as it is. And in our line of work, where we're trying to equip Christians for a faithful witness to the gospel to their Muslim neighbors, we see this fracturization as opening up many opportunities for the gospel which would otherwise not be there if Islam were a monolithic whole.
Since this is part of the major goal of the Zwemer Institute, in order to facilitate Christian witness among Muslims, given the fact that we're talking a Western context here and very few of us will ever darken the door of Mecca, with only about 30 seconds, how would you approach a Muslim here in America with that witness?
It all begins, really, it's just the same old basic principle that is so biblical and so exemplified by who Jesus was and what he did, that we love because he first loved us.
Dr. James Dretke, thank you very much for being our guest here on Issues, Etc.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and a joy.
Dr. James Dretke is director of the Zwemer Institute for Muslim Studies based in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We've been talking about the Muslims' annual pilgrimage to Mecca called the Hajj. When we come back from this break, Pastor Tom Baker joins us here in Studio A for part 5 of our 7-part series with him on a theology of the cross versus a theology of glory. Today we're going to find out what is the relationship between utter despair and saving faith. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.